Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93XFM here in Minneapolis and uprocks.com. I'm your host, Stephen Hayden. Today we're going to be talking about semi-forgotten bands of the early 2000s. I'm calling it the underbelly of the Meet Me in the Bathroom generation. The bands that came out after the Strokes hit it big and tried to follow in their footsteps to capture the zeitgeist. People with scruffy hair and leather jackets playing vintage-sounding guitars and all that kind of stuff. I have a lot of affection for this era, I guess because I remember it at the time. It's interesting when we talk about movements in music history because you always have these trendsetters that come along, whether it's the Strokes, Nirvana, whoever it is. And then there's a whole bunch of other bands that kind of follow in their footsteps. Some of them were already bands, you know, they're contemporaries of the trendsetter, and they end up breaking through. But a lot of other bands are just sort of ripping them off. You know, they're capitalizing on what is popular in the moment, and they're trying to get an audience because that's where the trend is. And those ripoff bands don't have a lot of authenticity, of course. And they, you know, we don't end up remembering them. They don't get written into rock history. We never talk about them sort of changing the culture or anything like that. But when you go back and you revisit certain eras in music history, a lot of times it's the ripoff artists who have the songs that you have the most affection for, you know, because they don't have the baggage that the trendsetters do. You know, I love the Strokes, but I don't really need to hear Is This It again. You know, that's been fully sort of integrated into my DNA at this point. But there are a lot of other records from that time that are less heralded that I do like to revisit. And I think deserve to be talked about, because even if they aren't changing the world, they are still really well crafted, and there's a lot of enjoyment that you can still get from listening to these records. This podcast was inspired by a band called The Stills, who are a band from Montreal, Canada. They put out their debut record in 2003. It's called Logic Will Break Your Heart. That record came out 15 years ago this month, which accounts for the timing of this podcast. Again, Logic Will Break Your Heart. You can listen to it. You can pick out the references. You can hear a little bit of Echo and the Bunnymen, a little bit of U2, even a little bit of Interpol. You know, Interpol was the band that this band was most compared to at the time. And again, you could call them a ripoff. You could call them carpetbaggers, whatever you want to call them. But to me, it's still a really good record. And I think it's an example of what I was talking about, how sometimes the second-tier bands that we forget about have a lot of pleasures to offer, and they deserve to be rediscovered, even if they're not going to be part of a oral history or a documentary about the time. So I called up our good friend here at Celebration, Rocky and Cohen, because I know that he has a similar affection for a lot of the bands of this era. And we both brought up three bands that we really like from that time. And I think it's going to be interesting. If you were listening to music at that time, I think you're going to remember some of these bands that you might have forgotten. Bands like Secret Machines, Hot Hot Heat, The Bravery, Long Wave, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club. You know, no one is really talking about these bands now, but I would argue that they all have at least two or three really great songs. And in some cases, some of them have like one really great record. After that, in many cases, they sort of fell apart, you know, and they quickly faded away and were swept up in the dustbin of history. But, you know, how many bands have even one great song, much less a great record? You know, it's a pretty great thing to even achieve that much. So we're tipping our cap here to some of the more unsung rock bands of the early 2000s in this episode. So it's a really great conversation. I think you're going to enjoy it. So without further ado, let's get into it. Here's me, Ian Cohen. So you and I were talking just amongst ourselves about this era of indie rock that was in the early 2000s, which we'll call the return of rock era, which I define it, and maybe you feel differently, we can get into this later, but in my mind, I kind of define it between like the release of Is This It to the first Killers record. Like that, like 2001 to 04, 05, there was this wave of bands, and it wasn't even indie rock, because a lot of these bands were signed to like big labels, but it was this thing of like chasing bands that people thought were sort of like the Strokes, or maybe they looked like the Strokes. You know, it was like four or five, you know, dudes with like scruffy hair playing guitars. And there was a whole rash of these bands. And, you know, when we talk about that era, you know, like the Meet Me in the Bathroom type New York stuff people talk about, you know, there's stuff like the White Stripes, the Vines, the Hives, those, I guess you would call them top tier garage rock bands. And then there's like the second tier bands that aren't as well remembered. And those were the bands that you and I were talking about just amongst ourselves. Bands that might have only had like one like pretty good record, or like maybe even just like one like great song that was like on a record that was solid. And then they kind of fizzled out after that, like when they put out their second record in like 06, 07, 08. People were sort of bored by them at that time. But I'm just wondering, I mean, because I feel some affection for those bands now. And I feel a lot of, I guess you could even call it nostalgia. Even though at the time, I feel like people were pretty skeptical of a lot of these bands that, again, they seem like maybe, you know, some of them seem like they were sort of chasing the trends, or like they were carpetbaggers or whatever. What are your feelings like looking back on that now? I mean, because I know, because you and I kind of feel the same way now. We have some affection for those bands. At the time, were you more skeptical of some of these groups?
Well, when, you know, I think what we're kind of exploring here is just the sense with like any sort of trend or whatever, like where, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats, you know, like a lot of the bands that got like the same way a lot of bands that, you know, you might not consider like grunge or whatever were, you know, uplifted by that influx of money. A lot of bands that we're going to be talking about today really don't have a whole lot to do. Like, they may have started before the Strokes, and they may not have had much to do with them. But, you know, it's like at the same time, they all kind of came together and were considered, you know, part of this new rock revolution. It was just this sort of thing that, and, you know, obviously people will be skeptical of these bands because, you know, like, it seems like once labels start throwing around money, it's like playing like scratch and wins. Like, that's what these bands were seen as, you know?
Right. And, well, and what inspired this conversation between us was talking about the Stills, this band from Montreal. And, you know, it's funny when we talk about anniversaries, like there's always the anniversary pegs with albums when we talk about them. And like, I feel like I've been doing 15th anniversaries a lot lately, which seems like a little bit of a cheat. Because, you know, it should be 10 or 20 or 5. But anyway, the 15th anniversary of the first Stills record, Logic Will Break Your Heart, is this month. I think it came out October 21st, 2003. And I'm pretty sure no one is going to do a think piece on this record. So I felt like in some way we have to mark the release of this record, because it's one of those albums that, like, I don't think anyone would ever say this is like an era defining masterpiece, or this album made people hear music in a different way, or, you know, it's a landmark. It's just like a really nice indie rock record that whenever I revisit it, it sounds better and better. Like, it's just like it's a well executed, it's a testament to craft, you know, type record. That again, like, it never blows anyone's minds, but it's the kind of album that I think tends to age really well. And the Stills, if you don't remember them, they were a band they formed in 2000. They're a four-piece from Montreal. They put out Logic Will Break Your Heart, their debut album, in 2003. It was preceded by an EP called Rememberies, which is a terrible title. But this was a band that was kind of grouped in with the post-punk revival of the time. I know they were compared to Interpol a lot. Although, when I listen to it now, I can hear some of that Interpol, you know, like, you know, I can see why that comparison was made. But to me, it's more reminiscent of, like, Love Is Hell era Ryan Adams. I think the Stills actually toured with Ryan Adams around that time. It has that sort of really lush, grand 80s rock sound. Maybe even slightly emo-ish in places, like a little bit of a Death Cab for Cutie type thing, although I don't think the band would have ever acknowledged that at the time. But it's just a really nice record, and I think it's an example of how when you have these great movements in music, you know, you always have the people at the front of the line pushing it forward, and then you have the bands in sort of the jet stream of those other bands, and again, they're not changing the world. They're not revolutionizing everything. But in those spaces, there's still a lot of room for craft and just well-written songs. And sometimes those are the albums that you enjoy revisiting more when you go back. And that's always my experience with this album. Like, I don't necessarily need to play the Strokes records from that time, maybe just because I overplayed them. But if I want to hear like a early 2000s rock record, Logic Will Break Your Heart just always seems to kind of push those buttons for mm-hmm. me in a way that maybe some of the first tier records don't. Like, what are your impressions of this album?
You know, I think that you mentioned it's like maybe not like a definitive work at the time because like it's not like canonical. Like it's not the sort of thing that like gets into whenever we do like our best of the 2000s or whatever. But it is kind of definitive in its own way, where in the same sense of like, you know, what was happening at that time and like the overall picture. And I think that the Stills like is kind of definitive of it because it sits at the intersection of like all these things. You know, it does have, you know, just the name, the Stills, similar to the Strokes, the Vines, and like Interpol and like some of the bands we're going to be talking about later, they pull from the same sort of grand 80s, like, because I mean, you want to call this an indie rock record maybe, but I mean, it was produced, like, it sounds incredible. Like, it's, there is not a lot of like indie rock production values on it. And it also does kind of like touch on, I mean, if we want to talk about like, you know, emo as defined by like Death Cab or like what it would be on the OC, then yeah, it's that too. It's kind of got that kind of like maundering, like self-pitying, but also kind of self-aware part to it. And I think you put up a good point of why this one perhaps sounds so good and so easy to revisit, because there's absolutely no baggage to it at all, you know, except for, you know, whatever. If you were our age back in like 2003, perhaps you would have seen these guys, you know, kind of being frauds or whatever, because they just sound like so slick and so well crafted and so stylized. But I mean, I was talking about this with a friend of mine who was, you know, he's about my age, and he doesn't really keep up with, you know, his favorite band of like the past 20 years is The National or whatever. So that shows you how much he like keeps up with the times. But, you know, he said to me, like, when he was living in Richmond, Virginia, like in 2001, like you would hear "Is This It" at every single bar. And the same with me, like with Interpol, Turn On the Bright Lights. That's what I was listening to every time I visited my friends in New York in 2002. So those are pretty inextricable from like, you know, my life experience at the time. Like those were just such formative, like, you know, as a budding person becoming aware of like, you know, the lineage of rock and roll. But like the Stills, it was just like, it was just kind of around and it never, you know, defined any period of time. They were never on any magazines. I don't recall seeing any videos of them ever, but it's just definitive in a way where it's like the same way, like someone brought up on Twitter the other day that it's sort of, maybe not even like the first Third Eye Blind album, but like it was just one of those things where, like, you know, like with the Gin Blossoms or bands of that kind of tier where they were just around if you were around.
Right.
They weren't like on magazines. They weren't like revolutionizing anything. But if you were just existing and remotely aware of what was going on, you just kind of stumbled upon a band like the Stills. And it just kind of gets there by osmosis, in the same way that like a lot of, you know, supposedly like post-grunge or alt-rock bands, people are like, you know what, they had some good songs. When removed from like the time, it's like, I think that's what the Stills are as well. And this record really holds up. It's very, each one kind of puts its own sort of, you know, vibe to it. And, you know, there's like the quote political songs and like
right.
the kind of more shimmery, like Echo and the Bunnymen sort of thing. And, you know, does it have any like sort of personality? I mean, it does have a personality and that's kind of like elegantly wasted dejection, but like, there's no Stilled sound, you know?
Right. And that's the thing about it, is that in a way, the lack of personality helps it in the long run, because mm-hmm. again, if you hear the Vines now, that seems so early 2000s. I mean, it's so tied to the era. Whereas
yeah.
I think the Stills record, if it came out like next week, it would sound like 2018. It just sounds like sort of beautifully produced, grandiose, indie-ish rock.
Yeah.
And in a way that you could say that that just means it's generic, but I also feel like it's also really well done and the songs are really good. I mean, to me, this is like one of the best examples of a record from that era that no one remembers if they weren't like in their 20s or teens and into rock music in like 2003. You know, like if you're a little bit older than that, you know, in 2003, or, you know, you were like in, you know, elementary school, you know, no one remembers the Stills, but like for a very narrow group of people, like this is kind of a touchstone record, I feel like.
Yeah.
It's definitely an album that if you read rock magazines or websites, you heard about this album and you were like, oh, this is like the next rock band I have to care about. And then they went away. Although this album too has like one of the all-time great Inscrutable Pitchfork reviews.
I was just going to bring that up.
Like the William Bowers. Well, I mean, William Bowers wrote a lot of reviews like that.
He's a wild dude. I met him in person a few times, and then he's a cool dude. And I think this era we're talking about too is like also kind of like the last of the Wild West era of Pitchfork or like blogs in general. So it's really fun to go back and see how like records of like bands like the ones we're going to be talking about were treated back then.
I was going to say, like, so Pitchfork gave this record a 5.1, and the money quote for me from this review is, he wrote, "The Stills are a complicated case, inspiring equal amounts of pleasure and horror, like that dream in which everyone has mozzarella genitals." I think that says it all, although I like the record more than that. That's a really good quote. But I feel like you read that and you're like, oh, I still want to hear this record. I mean,
yeah.
I want to hear the mozzarella genitals record. You're going to talk about a band now that I think, maybe unlike the Stills, I think the Stills probably were always a band that had like one really good record in them, and then they were probably going to be done.
Without Feathers is not a good record, yeah. I'll just tell you that.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, the record they put out after 2006, they kind of turned into like a full-fledged Americana band with that record. And I kind of feel like, okay, they were in that sort of Interpol vibe in 2003. By 06, that's when you're starting to see, like, okay, like the Conor Oberst, It's Wide Awake, It's Morning thing. Like, the indie rock had kind of turned more Americana-ish by then, so then they turned more Americana-ish. Like, so they were definitely one of those bands that was going to, like, sort of soak in what was happening elsewhere and put that onto their record, and they just weren't as good as at the Americana thing as they were at the sort of post-punk thing.
Mm-hmm.
But this next band, though, that you're going to talk about, I think is like kind of like a lost band from this era. Like, they're a band that to me really was great and maybe could have had a longer career if things had just gone differently for them, but it didn't work out. Like, would you say that? Like, who are you going to talk about?
Well, I believe we're going to be talking about the Secret Machines.
Yes.
And this is once again another very indicative of how, like, there were so many of these kind of like side tributaries of this new rock revolution, but like in retrospect, they all kind of like jumbled together to the point where one of the guys ended up playing for Interpol, even though they were from like Texas.
Yeah.
And, you know, clearly had nothing at all to do with that sort of wave. And the interesting thing about their first record, Now Here Is Nowhere, like, you did your retrospective on Dazed and Confused. I mean, like, these kids, you know, they were like guys from Texas, and their first record, it is clearly like Zeppelin, Laser Floyd, stuff that like had very little to do with the kind of like cosmopolitan, too cool New York sort of thing happening with like the Strokes, or even like the garage rock kind of shittiness of, not shittiness like bad, but like kind of like dirty and like dangerous sort of thing with like the White Stripes and the Von Bondies and all them. Like, Secret, like, Now Here Is Nowhere is like a classic rock record. The production, much like the Stills, is just like immaculate. You will find few rock records with a better sounding low end and a bigger rhythm section, which, you know, is just like, I think, kind of the secret weapon with a lot of these bands, particularly with like Sam from Interpol or even the rhythm section for the Strokes. But man, the Secret Machines, it's just, you kind of look back on that one and it's like they could, one of the guys, like, you know, unfortunately passed away, but like you figured they could have been like one of the big like festival rock bands of that time, you know?
Yeah, and you mentioned the classic rock influences, which are definitely apparent. I mean, just the drums on that record are so just like John Bonham, When the Levee Breaks type, you know, just humongous sounding drum breaks on that record, which, you never really hear that as much now.
No.
With like, I mean, drums are always like the most problematic part, I think, of most bands. And there just aren't a whole lot of like super talented drummers going around, at least playing in rock bands.
No.
But with the Secret Machines and their classic rock influences, it's not slavish about it, though. It's not like they're wearing the beads and the bandanas. And, you know, it's not like a Greta Van Fleet thing going on with them. They were able to incorporate that stuff into this sort of, you know, sort of futuristic sounding package. It was a way to take the sort of bombast of that older music and kind of fuse it with, like, you know, like more of like a krautrock type influence.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I guess, maybe like, kind of like a futuristic space rock type thing where, it didn't seem overtly retro. It seemed like it was kind of taking the power of that music and pushing it forward.
Yeah, it's not all that different than, like, I guess, like what you would describe Tame Impala doing today.
Right.
But, like, whereas, like, Tame Impala is, like, more in tune with the vibiness, I suppose, of, like, the current, you know, state of music. Like, Secret Machines were, like, a rock band. Like, there was no confusing them, like, with anything else. I mean, the album cover is, like, all white and their gear.
Right.
And I think that kind of helps out with the futuristic, because like it looks like in the inside of a space shuttle.
Right. Yeah, it looks amazing. And I mean, that record was really well regarded. It came out in 2004, so a little bit toward the end of this wave. But they put out their second record in 06, 10 Silver Drops, and it's a record that I like quite a bit, but I feel like in general this album wasn't that well regarded. It was more of an 80s sounding record, a little bit more U2-ish in parts.
Yeah.
And I know they ended up like supporting U2 around this time on tour. But then after that, you know, the band starts to fall apart. Benjamin Curtis, who was like one of the front men of the band, he left the band in 07, and then he, as you mentioned, he passed away in 2013 from lymphoma. He formed the band School of Seven Bells, which I know a lot of people, you know, there's
they're
some
pretty good.
Yeah, there's some partisans out there for me, but like again, like Now Here Is Nowhere. I just remember that record coming out and feeling like, oh yeah, this is going to be the arena band that comes from this scene. They just seemed like they had a big enough sound and just enough muscle that they could have ascended to that kind of status. And even now, like when I revisit that record, I'm kind of disappointed that like there aren't like 10 Secret Machines albums.
Yeah.
You know, like I feel like they should have been that band.
I think, you know, but you have to like consider that like 10 Silver Drops. I mean, like the first half of that record is like pretty awesome because it sounds like U2.
Right.
And then.
Oh, yeah. Alone, Jealous, and Stone, the first track.
Yeah, it sounds like Don't Stop Believin', like the first, like that's what I hear when I first, when the keyboards come in. But.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, like, and they actually released an album after that. I think it was self-titled, where, you know, it's pretty clear that the, you know, the inspiration or at least the, you know, the inter-band chemistry was gone. So it's not like they, you know, it's not like an unfortunate situation where, like, you know, they kind of broke up like at the peak.
Yeah.
Like it's just like, man, you really would have thought after that first one that, or maybe they just like kind of killed it on the first record.
Where yeah.
It's just like that was, cause it sounded like so fully formed and so like grand. It's like most bands don't get to that one until like the third record.
Right. Yeah. So, and I mean, I like the second record a lot. 10 Silver Drops, I think is like a really good record. It's interesting though, because they went in a less aggressive direction on the second one, and it did get more vibey,
mm-hmm.
which in a way, you know, maybe they were ahead of their time on that. Yeah, I feel like that is something that, like the big rock bands now, like the ones that kind of go in the more vibey, less overtly sort of
War
rock
drugs,
direction.
Yeah,
War on Drugs, bands like that, they seem to do well. I wonder, like, if at the time, if they had made maybe a harder rocking second record, if that would have made a difference, like just amp up the drums and have just some louder guitars.
Yeah,
you know, maybe that would have helped. I don't know. I'm speculating.
Well, 2006 was just kind of like a transition period where I don't know if like what would have really worked for them.
That's true. They were like, yeah, that's like when things started getting beardy and
yeah, that's like kind of where that
a lot
sort
of flannel shirts and all.
Yeah,
that.
It's like post OC. Well, I think what we're really talking about when you mentioned like, you know, being bracketed by the Strokes. It's like more like New Rock Revolution. It's like New Rock Revolution, and then you have like the OC, and that's the cutoff point.
Yeah.
And somewhere in the middle, you have like the Garden State.
I feel like the Killers to me makes sense just because I feel like they were like sort of the ultimate band that was inspired by the Strokes, but then they actually became more popular than the Strokes.
Yeah. You
know, they usurped them. And mm-hmm. and it's also the pinnacle of taking it away from the griminess of New York, that whole sort of iconography, and making it brighter and more danceable.
Well, the irony of that is when you read the, when, especially in like Meet Me in the Bathroom, like, you know, they all resent the Killers for, you know, doing the exact thing that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Whereas the kind of irony of it is that like the Strokes, Interpol, like even the Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs, I mean, those are rich kids.
Right.
You know, they may have been living like in really grimy conditions because, you know, they had the opportunity to do so. But I mean, like, the Killers, and particularly Kings of Leon as well, like, they come from, like, the Killers came from more of like kind of a working class, even though they're from Vegas, like more of like a working class. So like, of course we're going to try to like be commercial sort of mindset, which really triggered the resentment of a lot of the New York people, which it's so interesting that like they're seen as like kind of the not grimy, like sort of, sort of band in that conversation.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, they all wish they could have written Mr. Brightside. You know, there's so many bands that were trying to write Mr. Brightside, and they couldn't write that one huge song that lasts forever, including a band that I'm going to talk about next. And I think you have mixed feelings on this band, but I have affection for them, you know, even though it's qualified affection, and that's Long Wave.
Mm-hmm.
Long Wave was a band. They actually formed before, you know, the Strokes became a huge band. They formed in 1999, so they were, in a way, contemporaries of like a lot of these other New York bands, more successful bands. But I know for me personally, like I first heard about Long Wave because they were friends with the Strokes,
mm-hmm.
and that's how they were always written about at the time. Like, oh, these are like their friends, and they kind of look like the Strokes in their music videos. And they put out their first album in 2003. It's called The Strangest Things, and this is an album that like. You know, I'll stump for the Stills record being a really good record. I do think that's really good. The Long Wave record, Strangest Things, I think is a pretty good record. Like I would give it like a low sevens on the Pitchfork scale, maybe an upper sixes. But it does have, I think, a perfect song at the start of the record called Wake Me When It's Over, the first track, which whenever I think about this era, that's like one of the songs that kind of puts me back into that time, where again it's like what we're talking about here, where the trappings of the band are that they're this cool New York, you know, street level band, but this song is so arena rock. I mean, it's just an enormous drum beat. You know,
I think like, Dave Friedman produced that one, right?
Dave Friedman, yeah, did it. So yeah, it's got the Dave Friedman sounding drums. You know, there's this sort of grandiose, like kind of like mellotron playing in the background. You know, the vocal is, you know, it's definitely more Bono than Iggy Pop, you know,
yeah.
Like it's that kind of like aspirational, like singing to the heavens type thing. And I always love that song when I play this record, and then the rest of the record's pretty good after that. But a lot of these bands, from this time, you know, they were kind of good for that. Like there were so many bands that like had like one really great song and maybe that was it.
Yeah.
But, I kind of appreciate that about this era of bands, and maybe that speaks to them being on major labels and labels probably hearing songs like that and like wanting, that's why they wanted to spotlight them. Maybe they heard one song that they liked, because I mean, there's like a lot of bands now that are pretty good, but they don't have like that one song that is perfect.
Or maybe they do, but like, I mean, back in 2003, you know, we still had, a semblance of like a music industry or like some kind of like monoculture where like a band, at this time, like 2001 and 2, I worked at an alternative rock radio station. So, I mean, those things still existed, and they would play new bands. And right now, there just isn't, like, the infrastructure for, you know, or the money, for that matter. I mean, like, a major label could throw that kind of promotion at, you know, a Long Wave and make that video and get them on TV. And you know what? Like, maybe one of those songs exists now, but like, you know, maybe it just passes me by, or it's like you don't hear it enough times.
But you don't have, like, or like you said, with the production of some of these albums, like, they just sound immaculate, you know. In
yeah, they do not at all. I mean, they're not indie rock records, but yeah, it's just like they sound incredible, and I think that's a part of it too. I mean, when I interview a lot of bands these days, even like ones that are fairly successful on an indie rock level, they just talk about the importance of money.
Yeah,
you know, to have some kind of security to, you know, write the music and like have it sound good, and also to like promote it. I mean, this stuff matters. And at this time, like, you know, in the same way that like in, you know, after Nirvana, like major labels are going to like throw money at bands like, you know, the Melvins or whatever, or like Fordhams, they would just throw money at these bands that might not otherwise, like might otherwise put out like a boring or just like a nondescript album. But like, they, you know, the money behind it, like, gives it the exposure, gives it the sound, and you know what? I appreciate Long Way for that. Like, in a way, they're just as definitive of the time as the Strokes.
Well, and they had, like, you know, and by the way, they reunited this year, apparently.
I did see that.
And they're touring, and they might make a new record, but, like, they, you know, they had this first record, The Strangest Things, that came out in 2002. I don't remember this album really setting the world on fire or anything.
It did not.
But there were multiple videos made for it. And even, like, by their third record, There's a Fire, they were working with, like, John Leckie, who's, like, a pretty famous rock producer, and I'm assuming he wasn't cheap to bring on board.
He produced The Bend, so you could probably guess what they were going for there. And My Morning Jacket Z.
Right. So, you know, so even by, like, their third album, they were still, I mean, there was still some money behind them, apparently, to get John Leckie on board to work with them.
Yeah,
it really speaks to what you're saying, that, you know, there was an idea that, like, wow, like a band like Long Wave might be like a multi-platinum band if we just spend enough money on them, which now you look at it and you're like, why in the world would anyone have thought that this band, you know, would have been huge? But yeah, there really was that sort of, I guess, you liken it to like the post-Nirvana sweepstakes of the 90s. There was that existing too in the early 2000s, even though none of these bands like sold as well as Nirvana or Pearl.
No, not even. They didn't even sell as well as like Local H, you know, like.
Right. But it was, you know, the implosion of the record industry was also happening at this time. This is also like when things were just rapidly falling apart. You got some, Derek?
I just wanted to point out, as someone who works at a rock station in 2018, that they still exist. They're still a thing.
Oh, Long Wave?
Not Long Wave, but the radio stations. And I mean, there are, you know, look, yeah, there's still 21 Pilots and Imagine Dragons.
Well,
and
yeah, I know,
like
but
that.
Like, but
yeah,
like,
but the Long Wave of that.
But I'm just, yeah, I'm just yeah. saying that, like, yeah, they're at the top. But yeah, like, Long Wave is like at the second or maybe even third tier level. And like, for labels to be spending that much money on their third record, you know,
yeah.
when they've never had, you know, it just
you don't get the third record anymore, 100%.
Yeah, yeah, it just speaks to how much more money there was that you could spend that amount of money on, like, a band like that. But
maybe,
yeah,
John Leckie produced them because he thought he might get to the Strokes.
Right. Yeah, maybe Julian Casablancas will walk in the studio at some point, or Albert Hammond Jr. While they're recording this record. You're going to talk about a band now that is actually, I mean, they've kind of had like a longer career. I mean, they just put out a record, I think, a year or two ago, right? We're talking about Black Rebel Motorcycle Club.
Oh, yeah. Now,
they've hung in there.
Yeah, this band is interesting because, I mean, like, as you said at the top of the show, you know, they had the look, you know, the leather jackets, they had the hair, they got their name from a Marlon Brando movie, and the influence, and also, here's another part of it that I think is maybe more unusual in 2018, like, it might be tough for, like, younger people to grasp, but I think, along with the Strokes, they were one of those bands that, from America, who got big in the UK first.
Yeah.
And when they came, you know, back over, it's like, wow, who's this hype band from the UK?
I remember thinking that they were British at the time.
Exactly.
Because I never...
That's how good it was. But
right.
But yeah, I mean, they were interesting. And like, they're kind of like the Stills in a way, where they didn't... Like, they were, you know, pure record collector rock, but like, theirs was more geared towards the thing that kind of tailed them is that, you know, they're a Jesus and Mary Chain ripoff, which, I mean, not even like Psycho Candy ripoff, because, like, I mean, that's, like, this was a very well-produced album as well, but, like, they were, like, more like major label Jesus and Mary Chain, the stuff I would occasionally hear on the radio in the 90s.
Right, and, like the less cool Jesus and Mary Chain.
Exactly.
Records.
Like, Yeah, it's a but yeah, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, they're an interesting sort of band in this kind of discussion, because you're right, they did put out a record recently, and once again, I'm not going to like use Los Angeles as being indicative of like the rest of the world, but like a little subsection of it is, in that like I meet people who don't really keep up with music very much, like, but they're like an unusual number of people I meet like still like Black Rebel Motorcycle Club.
Oh yeah,
they're like a band. Like there's this kind of like subsection of bands, and I think the best way to group them is like the Desert Days Festival that happens in, you know, it's happening a couple of weeks from now. I think, you know, I think like My Bloody Valentine and like Tame Impala are playing it, but it's that sort of wave of like kind of psychedelic sort of bands from, you know, like Brian's Jonestown Massacre.
Yeah,
and like you'll find out that like a band like Black Angels that is like super popular in ways that is unquantifiable, like, you know, in the music critic world. But yeah, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club kind of got eventually lumped into that world, and they've been able to kind of sustain a pretty decent career, at least, you know, compared to some of these other guys we talk about. But
yeah,
their first record,
I was gonna say, like, they played First Avenue here in Minneapolis, which is like, you know, 2,000 people club or so. I mean, that's a pretty good, you know, not
yeah.
many bands can do that.
No,
so,
I mean,
and that was earlier this year that they did that.
Yeah, and in a way, they speak to the both rock is dead. Like, you know, whatever way you want to look at it, it's true, because, you know, that I'm sure that I don't know how many young people are finding out about Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, but like the people who do like them, you know, there's still an audience out there for it.
Right. Well, it's probably someone who bought that first record in, you know, 2004, and they still have it in their car.
Now, this is from 2001.
Was it 2001
record.
That early?
Yeah, they actually it like came out before Is This It.
Oh, so I just remember that. Is that song Love Burns on that
yeah.
record? I remember liking that song. Yeah, I mean, I
they also had a song Whatever Happened to My Rock and Roll, which, you know, is that it's so funny because like so many of these bands like are just. You know, it's like at the same time, like rock and roll is back. They were talking about like rock and roll being like dead or whatever. I mean, this is like the constant push and pull that always happens.
Well, and they definitely had that Strokes thing too, Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, like where they're wearing like the leather jackets on stage and like mm-hmm. the sunglasses and the promo photos. And it's very much about, you know, like a very like rock, like R-A-W-K type thing. Like we've got the attitude and the look. And
yeah, but I heard they were like super nerdy in person.
Right. Well, I think you have to be to have that kind of romanticism for that kind of rock music. I mean,
yeah,
it's
exactly.
not the cool people that are into that. It's like the record nerds that are into that sort of music. And I, you know, group myself into that, and probably you as well. But yeah, this is yeah.
They got kind of rootsy towards like the middle of the 2000s as well. I remember.
Yeah, it was with that record Howl that came
yeah.
out. That's sort of like, yeah, it's a little bluesier, maybe.
Yeah, which is also funny because, like, I mean, you know, like, naming after Alec Ginsberg, I mean, like, this is the sort of stuff, like, especially, like, Name Yourself After the Wild Ones and, like, all those authors. It's, like, the joke nowadays is, like, hey, this is, like, your like, your high school boyfriend's, like, book collection or something like that. It's, like, I bet they're really into Kerouac, too. It's, like, all that stuff that, like, could seem super-duper cool, like, you know, at the beginning of the 2000s, or at least to, like, you know, young people who are into rock, it's, like, a band like Black Rebel Motorcycle Club in, like, 2018 would just be, like, basically, like, beach slang.
Yeah, but, you know, the thing is about, you know, you can kind of look at it at in their time, there was sort of, like, an anachronistic thing about them, but when you're an anachronism, it also allows you to move through the times a mm-hmm. little bit easier than a lot of bands. Like, again, there's so many bands from the early 2000s and after that it just evaporated into the air, you know.
Yeah.
you only remember if you were alive at the time, and it kind of, you know, it reminds us that a lot of the bands that now that people think are really huge or important, or a lot of the artists are not going to be remembered in like 2 or 3 years.
Nope.
So Black Rebel Motorcycle Club, they kind of won in the long run. I mean, they're still doing it. They're still wearing the leather jackets and the shades. So it's
yeah,
good for them.
I mean, it's an interesting thing where it's like, you know, you can be like of the moment or just be kind of anachronistic. And, you know, there are bands like right now who are, will not be talking about, like, they're kind of popular, but in 15 years, you're just going to be like, oh yeah, they're going to be like the Stills of their time. Like, I don't know who that band is, like Hippocampus. I don't know.
We're going to do a podcast in like 2033 on Hippocampus.
We very well might.
Speaking of bands that are like super trendy, the next band that you're going to talk about is a band that I definitely associate with the early 2000s. And I don't mean this in a negative way, because I actually like their records, although I haven't listened to them in a while, but I remember liking them. But Hot Hot Heat.
Oh, yeah.
To me, if you were going to make a joke about early 2000s rock music, Hot Hot Heat would work as a punchline, just because it sounds like a very sort of early 2000s rock band name.
This band really exists. Like, I mean, even perhaps even more so than the Stills, like, this band is, yeah, very early 2000s, because they had the hair and like the kind of tight pants, and they were sort of, you would describe them as like angular or whatever. But they also had one part we didn't talk about is like the kind of dance punk element of it as well. Like, they weren't like, you know, like a DFA band the same way like the Rapture were. But, you know, you could dance to their music. Like, it was very rhythmic, and, you know, they were also, and I've also seen them called, like, emo, which is funny because, you know, they're, like, clearly like an indie rock band from Vancouver on Sub Pop, and actually one of the guys is in Wolf Parade now. But, you know, these are songs with, like, a really yelpy lead singer, just, like, really off-key singing about, like, drinking and, like, girls and, like, how he's, like, really bad at both. And it's also kind of a soft launch for, I guess, the Killers in a way. Like, you can draw like them as being like perhaps one of the avenues that get us from like the Strokes to the Killers. And yeah, I mean, the first record, I just listened to that this morning because, you know, I like to do my homework, and I just can't imagine something like this coming out now on Sub Pop. It's just
Let's make up the breakdown.
Yeah, make up the, and you know, they had some EPs before then that were really well regarded as well. But I mean, this is the sort of, you know, the sort of thing at the time where it's like, it is an indie rock record. It's not like slick, but it's catchy. And just the kind of like, I mean, there was like, obviously like some bad things happening in the world at the time, but it just seems like kind of unaware, like, music of that time is just like so apolitical, and this is just a record about like being young and drunk, like, you know, naked in the city again, the first song. It's just about like just being like in your early 20s and just like getting fucked up and like, you know, striking out with like girls and like all that stuff, which, you know, as someone who was also like 22 at the time and just like, you know, getting out of college, it's like, oh yeah, this is like soundtrack of my life kind of stuff.
Yeah, that is the weirdness about at least rock music at that time, is that like after 9/11 and then, you know, getting into two wars, people were not wanting to write songs about that. It was songs about, yeah, getting drunk and partying, and that was the tenor of the times, because people were just like, I need an escape, you know, things are too brutal now. And I kind of understand the logic of that. I mean, sometimes that is a nice thing about music, that you could turn it on and get a break. I mean, you know, God knows that we could all use a break, mm-hmm. maybe more these days. I was also thinking about Hot Hot Heat. I don't know if this totally applies to them, but there was this weird moment around this time where there were a bunch of bands influenced by like late 70s XTC.
Yeah, like kind of new wavy sort of thing.
Which seems totally bizarre. Like, that seems insane to try to explain to someone now, that like that was a touchstone for like many bands, because that just seems like such like an obscure reference.
Yeah, that, or like, you know, kind of the early Elvis Costello, or
yeah,
there's just this new wave kind of thing going on, which of course, when you look at like what you know, the Strokes were doing, like Television and you know, the Ramones, I mean, like that stuff was happening alongside it as well. So it just speaks to the kind of like cyclical nature of rock music, at least for now, and like how, you know, these separate scenes from other eras can just kind of meld together.
They're also sort of like late, like early Cure, right? I mean, like
they had a song called In Cairo at the end of the record, which is, you know, like kind of a reference to a Cure song, like Fire in Cairo. So yeah.
The last band we're going to talk about, this is a band that's kind of controversial, because you were disputing whether this band even belongs in this podcast, and I made a case for them belonging, because I feel like they are a sign of maybe the end of this era, and that is the Bravery.
Mm-hmm.
And because the Bravery, of course, I think if you remember them at all, it was because they had a short-lived feud with the Killers. Like,
yeah.
They were perceived to be sort of a bald ripoff of the Killers. And to me, that makes them interesting to include here, because instead of bands following in the path of the Strokes, now we have bands following in the path of the Killers. And so that, so now they're the new standard bearers of at least this kind of rock music. But, you know, the Bravery, you know, they formed in 2003. So they became a band, you know, after it was clear that if you were a band in New York, that you could actually become, if not rich, at least famous for a while. And you can hear it in certainly their first record, their self-titled record, which came out in 05, which, I mean, to me, it's like a very crass record. There's a very prefabricated aspect of the record. But there's also songs on there that I think are sort of undeniable bangers, and starting with An Honest Mistake, which I think is like a really great single from this time. Totally a disreputable single in a lot of ways. I mean, this band, like, they wore the leather jackets. They had the lead singer with, like, it was sort of like a porcupine type bouffant thing.
Yes.
They were sort of like taking everything that was sort of cool at the time, or had been cool maybe 2 or 3 years earlier, and repackaged it in, again, this very kind of crass package, sort of like a barely concealed pop package, really. I don't think anyone ever looked at the Bravery and thought, oh, yeah, these are like the authentic New York rockers, as there was, like, with that was at least the mythology of the Strokes, like, when they first came out. But the Bravery were just like, oh, these are just totally ripoff carpetbaggers, trend hoppers. But they have good songs. And I remember thinking at the time, like, oh, this might be this decade's Stone Temple Pilots, you know?
Yeah.
Like, the band that, like, has no authenticity, but has a lot of, like, catchy songs. And they get sustained by that way. But that didn't really happen. I mean, I know their next record did pretty well. It had that song, Believe, on there.
Yeah, I Never Had a Summer of 69, which is very, very, like, right. It's. I mean, that's like a real, like, a powerful kind of statement. Like, I just think that, I'm like, dead serious about it, because, you know, it's just about, like, kind of, like, the false, you know, the how nostalgia is, like, the kind of a false thing or whatever, and just, you know, people these days might think, you know, I never had that kind of, like, you know, the Summer of 69 or whatever, like, your song is, like, about, like, young, reckless youth and just, like, kind of not being able to relate to that. I thought that was pretty profound. But, yeah, I think we can't go any further without mentioning Skava the Hutt. That was, like, part of the beef they had with the Killers, really, because they used to be in a ska band.
Right. Right, which, like, in the late 90s.
Yeah, they were more innocent times, you know?
Yeah, which, you know, again, it speaks to how, you know, kind of like the Stills moving with the trends in indie rock, that this was another band that it's like, oh, well, people are playing dancey New Order sounding records now, so, like, we're going to sound like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sort of mercenary thing that exists in music, which, you know, people question, but it's also a sign of, like, well, these are just strivers, you know, they're professionals,
yeah,
going with where the audience is.
Do you think this was, like, kind of the last time in rock and roll where you could sort of be considered a sellout, and some of these credibility issues that I've dogged a couple of these bands have talked about? Like, I feel like those are things that don't really exist in today's
discussion. What are you going to sell out for, you know?
Well, I will say that any band that becomes really popular is usually subject to not being called a sellout, but I think
nowadays they call you an industry plant.
Yeah, or that, I mean, that's the funny thing about, like, the sort of poptimism thing is that it doesn't really apply to rock bands that get really popular. Like a band like Coldplay, for instance, that is, like, you know, whatever else you want to say about them. I mean, if you're a pop music fan, there's certainly great pop music aspects to Coldplay, but they're an automatic punchline, or the Foo Fighters being another band. That, you know, Foo Fighters have, if you look at their history, I mean, you know, Dave Grohl was in Nirvana. They certainly put out really well-respected records in the 90s, but they're sort of looked at as, like, almost, I mean, I hear people liking them to Nickelback or something now.
Yeah, I mean, they're, like, kind of a more credible version of that, or, like, they're seen as, like, I don't know, like the same level as like the Red Hot Chili Peppers, where they're just this band that like releases a new record like every 4 years, gets like 3.5 stars in Rolling Stone, they headline a festival, and like that's, you know, that's, it's like clockwork, you know?
Yeah, I just can't think of like a scenario like where a band could get really popular, a rock band, and also still have credibility anymore. I just feel like it's not set up that way.
It's the glitch in the Poptimist matrix, because like, you know, you can't really like, I mean, a lot of it is like a cult of personality, which kind of, even if you do have a very compelling front man, it's like you're still a band.
Right.
You can't look at a band and say that, you know, that's me. Like, you can't use that as like kind of an avatar for, I don't know, your view of the world. But, you know, also it's like, I don't think any, like, yeah, it just doesn't apply to Imagine Dragons, but like, I listen to Imagine Dragons too, and I'm like, I don't like this.
Yeah, right.
Well, they're a punchline, I think, for a lot of people too.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of that stuff is pretty fucking bad.
Derek is always inserting Imagine Dragons into episodes here.
I have
the Imagine Dragons button, and then you will insert them into a conversation.
I don't actually like their music.
I think they get a bad rap.
They're like an interesting talking point. I feel like they're more fun to talk about than
to. I feel like I've like that. That's what makes me feel old. That like I don't like. I don't know like who my current version of like the Stills or the Bravery or like, you know, these corny ass rock bands that.
Well, I feel like you and I are on the same page on the last Mumford and Sons record where they like ripped off the National.
Like, they had like two good. There was like a couple of good songs. On that. Like, you're at Ralph's every now and again.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll defend like I'll go up four songs on that album that I think are like pretty solid, like songs that like if they came on in a bar I would be like, oh yeah, this is,
yeah,
which,
I mean,
that will never happen.
Or even like Kings of Leon, like, I mean, I never liked them, but I mean, you, it's still like, yeah, I guess.
Oh, I'll
like,
defend Kings of Leon. I'm on their team. I even came around on their bad albums, like or the Come Around Sundown era.
Oh yeah, where, the Come Around Sundown,
where they were
that's
making
the first. That's the first time I ever hear it. But like, then again, it's like they're a band that kind of emerged from this as well, and like they wouldn't have gotten to that Come Around Sundown era had they not had that sort of infusion of like money and hype at the beginning, you know?
Right. And you know, I just didn't, you know, I didn't bring them up in this conversation because yeah, they're
they transcend.
Yeah, they're on the top tier.
I saw them on a co-headline tour with Secret Machines actually, so just to bring that full circle.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That would have been like 07 or something.
It would earlier than that, I think.
That would have
been
like 03 or
oh, like been, Aha Shake era.
Oh god,
that'd have been good.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you got weird combinations like that too. Like I remember like people saying like they saw the Strokes opening for Doves.
Oh yeah,
it, you know, brings in the whole like, you know, fake Radiohead sort of.
Oh man, that makes me think we have to do an episode like this about like the British wing of
because
the Doves would be in there. Like all the sort of, you know, well, you were talking about Keane the other day.
Oh, yeah.
On Twitter.
Yeah, they're like the Kings of Leon from like
the Coldplay angle.
Yes.
You know, all the like Coldplay following bands. Although, but again, the Coldplay.
I do think this kind of like brings it like full circle in the sense of like there was an industry that was like supporting like rock music of all stripes. So,
yeah,
you know, it's like you could. You know, you listen to Ray, you heard like Jimmy Eat World, and you heard like the Strokes, and you heard like Coldplay. I mean, like they were like clearly like, different sort of waves, but at the same time, it was like this is what you heard when you listened to rock radio.
Yeah,
and now it's just like you associate them all kind of the same in a weird way.
And also, again, just like the ability to have like that second tier, where again, you're always going to have like the superstar acts, but sometimes. Mm-hmm. When you go back and you revisit some of these eras, it's more fun to look at those sort of second tier bands that were good, not great, but they also weren't as rammed down your throat. So there's room for pleasant surprises sometimes with some of these bands. And
that's what I'm hoping for us doing this episode.
I think all six of these bands, there's tunes. There's at least like a song or two that's great. And some of them have whole albums that are great.
Yeah.
Most of them don't have multiple albums that are great. But again, you know, to have just one album that's really good.
Yeah,
that's
a big deal.
It's a big deal. So, all right, man. Well, put it on your calendar. We got to do a British version of this at some point.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to bone up on Turn Breaks and Elbow. And
oh, yeah.
I mean, not that I have to. Like, this stuff is already very, very to the forefront of my memory. But, you know, just like... JJ72, Star Sailor. Oh, man.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like already excited.
Oh, me too, man. Awesome. Ian, always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks
dude.
Thanks for taking time. We'll talk again soon.
All right, later.
All right, man. Take care. All right, that was me and Ian talking about it. And, you know, I think we have to do that British episode. What do you think?
I'm so in for that. you need someone to talk Block Party? I'm here for
you. Oh, yeah. We got to talk about Block Party. Yeah. Yeah. It's so funny because, like, the more you talk about this era, it just jogs the memory. Like, there's so many bands that I have not thought about in probably 10 years. Yeah. And then you punch it into Spotify and you're like, oh, this is actually pretty good. I might listen to this again.
Yeah. When Ian was talking about Doves, I was like, ooh, pulling that up on Spotify.
Oh, yeah.
Right now.
Doves. I think Doves had multiple good records.
Yeah, they did.
All right. So thanks again for listening, everyone. Thanks again to the man who makes it happen, Derek Madden, who's off listening to the Doves right now. Thank you to Josh Copperman for writing our theme song. And of course, again, thank you to all of you Celebration Rock Pod listeners for supporting us. We would not be here without you. So thank you for leaving reviews of our podcast on iTunes and talking about us on social media and telling your friends about us. The word of mouth is always the best advertising. So thanks again, everyone. We will be back again next week with more Celebration Rock. Until then, take it easy.
On the Westwood One Podcast Network.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draftaccess to register for free entry today.